The Lisa Wexler Show podcast is brought to you by Jill Zarin Rugs. Did you know that Jill Zarin Rugs are water-resistant and pet-friendly? Go to jillzarin.com and use the promo code FRIENDOFLISAWEXLER for an additional 10% off. Also brought to you by Onboard Services. For your staffing and engineering needs, go to onboardusa.com.
It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
Good morning. Lisa has the day off. This is Ann Carrick on a rather gloomy, rainy day. Kind of feels like we're in Seattle today. Our first guest this morning is going to revisit us. She was here before. We're going to talk about ranked choice voting. It's going on as far as trying to get it passed in Massachusetts. So we're going to talk to her about what the chances are of it ever being a national thing and also how it's going in Massachusetts. We're also going to talk to Personality Hacker and take a look at personality types, how they communicate, how they interact, and the pluses and minuses. Well, I shouldn't say it that way. They're not better or worse, but just how to deal with different types of personalities. From Access Health Connecticut, later in the show, we have two people who are going to be on. We're going to talk about the health plans, tax credits, new laws, new options, and we'll wrap up today with people from Mission Training Center, which is in Southport, and you've probably never heard of it, but you should have heard of it. At first glance, it kind of looks like it's a gym, but the reality is it's much more than just a gym. They do a lot of work with people who have overcome cancer and now have new goals that they want to pursue. So the first guest this morning is going to be Alan Morehouse. She's with Represent.us. We talked about her last week, and or so I should say spoke with her about the grassroots campaign that they're putting together so that they can try to get rid of some of the government corruption and kind of get back to the democracy that we're all used to. This morning, Alan is joining us to talk specifically about ranked choice voting. So, Alan, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good to be with you. Good.
Excellent. So we touched on it when you were here before. Here, I say that, you know, here with us. Maybe not here in this studio. But that Massachusetts was looking at ranked choice voting. So tell us first, you know, how's that going in Massachusetts?
So Massachusetts is my home state and is currently in the process of gathering signatures to meet a deadline to get ranked choice voting on the ballot for 2020.
And does it look like it's going to happen?
It does. The organization is called Voter Choice Massachusetts, Voter Choice NA, and there'll be a couple rounds of signature gathering, but they need at least 80,000 valid signatures this round and to turn it in by November 20th, and by all accounts, they're going to hit and well exceed that. They've got a huge grassroots apparatus across the state, both here in Western Mass, where I'm based, as well as the Boston area, and even Worcester as well. So, yeah, I think they're going to do it. And if they do, they'll become the second state to use ranked choice voting in statewide elections.
Which is the other state?
Maine.
Maine
became the first in 2018. Maine is leading the way.
All right, so Maine is leading the way. That is not something you often hear. But okay.
Yeah, it's a wonky electoral reform, right? It's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, for the voter, ranked choice voting is pretty straightforward. Instead of just voting for one person, you know, I don't know if they're going to limit how many you can have, but let's say there's five candidates. Instead of just choosing the one you want, you look at all five and you put them in order of your choice. One, two, three, four, five. You vote for all
That's
five
right.
of them. So go ahead.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. So we rank things in our everyday lives, you know. So once you get to that ballot box, instead of what we currently have, we call first past the post or plurality voting, ranked choice voting would ensure that a candidate wins with a majority. So you get inside that ballot, and instead of just picking one, you know, maybe you actually, your true preference is another candidate, but you know they won't win, or maybe if you vote for that person, you're afraid someone you don't want to win will actually win. That's called the spoiler effect.
Right.
Voting can help mitigate all that.
Well, and certainly if there's a third party candidate where sometimes people would kind of like that person, but they feel like their vote is just being wasted, they can still vote for that person and then put their second choice so that if that person doesn't have enough votes, their second choice becomes their vote.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
I was just going to say, from the voter standpoint, I think it's very straightforward. You know, as a math person, I wonder about the algorithm to tally up the votes and whether that will create doubt in people's minds if they don't follow the process of how, you know, like, do they feel like their first vote just got eliminated and it's all being skewed or there's fraud or something like that? Do you have information about, you know, sort of how the algorithm is going to be set up to deal with that?
So in most cases, it's established by the Secretary of State in each individual state. And you're so right that voter confidence is among one of the highest things that we can do with electoral reforms like ranked choice voting, right? If the voters don't believe that their vote actually counted or that they wasted a vote, then it's not actually doing what it's supposed to do. So when we use ranked choice voting and you get in that booth, you know, if a candidate has 50% or majority vote, then they win automatically. And the sort of counting algorithm is a moot point.
Right.
But if no candidate has a majority first past the gate, then who had the least is eliminated. And if that was your first choice, your then vote is then allocated to your second and all the way down the line. So in that way, I think voters can assume that their vote is exceptionally not wasted, right? It's actually, in the current system, I would argue, you know, you only get your one say and done. But with ranked choice voting, I'm able to indicate preference and selection and choice. It sort of gives me more voice as a voter. So I think that it'll let more independent and nonpartisan and third-party candidates into the race if you actually want to vote for those people, because quite frankly, our two-party system doesn't accurately represent a huge majority of Americans in our country anyway. So if we want to cast a preference, our ballot for someone else, then this will actually allow us to do so.
Oh, I agree with you on that. Do you know for Maine and certainly Massachusetts, are they going to limit the number of people or, you know, like right now, for example, with the Democratic 2020 presidential candidates, there's still quite a few. And I think as people, whenever you have to rank things, like the first maybe up to five, you know which ones are your top five. And then after that, it gets a little fuzzy and people have a tendency to kind of just like, whatever, put something. I'll just put something down because I have to put all the rest of these in order kind of thing. Is there going to be some sort of limit on how many candidates like make the cut to even be on the ballot?
Yes, and actually right now in New York City, which if enacted would be one of the biggest cities to actually use ranked choice voting in terms of population, they've enacted a top five as well.
Which makes more sense to me personally, yeah. Right.
You got it, yeah. And there's even questions around primaries, right? Some states will choose to use it for primaries and some for statewide elections. So we're actually just beginning to explore the forefront of what this reform could actually be and look like and implement things that make sense in different states that work accordingly to their laws and state constitutions. So I think yes, and it's always an exciting state to figure that out.
So Maine already has it. Massachusetts looks like it's definitely going to be on the ballot. We'll see what happens as far as voting. Any other states you know of that are already considering it?
Yeah, there's a huge push. Memphis, Tennessee, another city, Amherst, Massachusetts, and the biggest one on my mind right now is New York City, which actually will vote on it November 5th.
Right. You kind of cut out your phone there before you said New York. What was the state you said before New York?
New York City. New York is the biggest one on my mind right now. New York City actually will vote November 5th. It's fast coming up. So very excited to see what happens there.
Okay. So there are some places already looking at it, even though we haven't heard a lot about it. Do you think this is something that could ever take hold nationwide?
I do. I think this type of reform and others, right, things like campaign finance reform, ethics and transparency, individually these reforms can sort of seem wonky and maybe like they can't ever possibly impact a system as big as we have in our country. But when we're faced with sort of this broken system that hasn't really been working on behalf of anyone, right, hyper-partisan primaries, moving our candidates more and more to the left, it's not actually representing a majority of Americans who now maybe identify as moderate or independent or unaffiliated. So I think that ranked choice voting is a huge tool in our election reform toolkit to actually get us to a system that can better represent Americans.
Right. And I know like anybody who's done any kind of computer programming can probably, without actually writing the code, can sort of figure out how you'd be like, all right, if this candidate has already been eliminated, then go to choice number two. Let's read that one. If that one's eliminated, go to choice number three. You know, do you know who has been? You said the Secretary of State. Is each state going to be sort of slated with figuring out that coding for themselves, as far as you know?
I do believe so. And I think it will be up to both the legislature and the state body governments to actually enact what works best for them. Once the people pass it at the ballot, then comes implementation. So what looks right and proper and fair and objective in terms of not only the people's eyes, but ultimately the government institutions implementing these reforms, I do think it will be up to each individual state to figure out an algorithm and accounting that is fair and objective.
Right. For the states or the locations, I should say, because they're not all states, as you mentioned, New York City is a city, not a state. For the places that are looking to adopt this, I know you said a lot of them have put a cap at five. How are they determining the ones you know, like to the, who those top five are? How are they making that determination?
I think it has a lot to do with our primaries and how we cast ballots in that way in individual cities and states. And it truly varies at this point. So I know in Michigan, for example, a local chapter leader there is driving forward ranked choice voting in Ferndale and would ultimately consider the number five as well with an amendment that they might be able to encompass other rules, laws, and regulations in the future, right? So actually baking in an ability to be able to react and adapt to what comes down the line.
Yeah, because I know I'm just thinking about, for example, I keep using the 2020 presidential candidates on the Democratic Party because people keep hearing about them. They can see there's like this whole crowd of people. And of course, they have requirements to be in the debates. You know, different debates have different requirements. And a lot of those have been signatures and money raised, which to me, if money, like for example, for ranked choice voting, if money raised is the criteria, I'm like, well, that sort of is counterproductive to the whole point, which is to allow people to run who don't necessarily have a huge backing of some party. Or in other words, the whole idea is to kind of let people who are qualified, who want to run without having some huge following already.
Definitely. And here you're sort of already backing into what I would actually view as the bigger issue of all of this, which is corruption and money in politics, right? Those rules are set by big party systems like the DCCC, who actually set those rules and regulations for who qualifies. So, 2018 elections were a whopping $5.19 billion. 2020 is expected to outpace that. Are we really sort of using the right reforms to begin to tackle big money in politics and how that controls the voice of the American people? And I think that ranked choice voting is one leg of the policy that can ultimately reform this entire system. I think campaign finance reform is needed as well. I think we need to tackle how we draw our districts. We've heard of gerrymandering, the legislatures that actually control the very lines with which we vote. So I think you're spot on there. I think there are big money entities who have a vested interest in maintaining a status quo, and that reforms like these, sort of state by state, individual local solutions starting with local people, can begin to tackle some of these head on in the future.
Yeah. That's why I keep applying it to the presidential race, because I'm like, let's say we have that, we don't want money like raised to be the criteria to be on the ballot. I'm like, I don't care how much money you raised. Maybe you have rich friends. I want to know like that somebody else, that there are people who consider you a viable candidate because of who you are and what you're offering and what your thoughts are on different issues.
That's right. And even a more, to sort of broaden the sphere here, Seattle uses something called Democracy Dollar, which is actually a tax voucher. Each voter gets $100 for $25 tax vouchers. And then politicians actually vie for those vouchers that that voters have put into. So, they're exploring ways to actually use and leverage what we consider to be big money in politics and actually kind of change the game on that, because it hasn't been serving anyone. It's been sort of the big money, special interest view dictating policy at a global scale for quite some time now.
We've got
to break through that.
Well, and of course, they always talk about reform, like they're going to change how the system works as far as, raising money to run for office. But there's a lot of talk, but we don't see a lot of changes, actually.
Oh, yeah. And right, so herein comes what we talked about in the beginning, voter confidence. And ultimately, does ranked choice voting, will you think as a voter when you leave that booth, that your vote has counted. And I really like to think so, but we all know sort of this cynical marketing machine that we're operating inside of. And will the average American feel that at the end of the day, this new system has counted them? I truly hope so.
Yeah, I know, you know, because I work the elections for the town I live in. I run one of the polling locations as a moderator. I kind of started it, and, you know, now once you're in, unless you say, like, I want out, they just keep asking you to come back, you know.
Civic duty.
Yeah, right,
civic
yeah. duty. It's interesting, and I've often said to people who, you know, are very concerned that someone is, you know, hacking into the system or, you know, like doing something to change the outcome of the actual votes. And I said, I'm not going to tell you it's impossible, because if somebody is really focused on doing something, I suppose, you know, if they work hard enough, they could find a way. I said, but there are a lot of checks and balances that the typical voter never sees. And so I always say,
absolutely,
if you really want to know, you know, go to your registrar or voter and, you know, ask if you can be a poll worker this year, because by sitting through the classes and the training and then seeing all the paperwork and the cross-checking and the, you know, and everything that's done, I think you'll see that, okay, this would be much more challenging to go in and create fake votes than you think. You know, in Connecticut, it uses the tabulator system, which is a computer where you scan the ballot. And that system was chosen because Connecticut wanted a paper trail so they could recount by hand if they needed to, which I have been involved in an audit where they recount like one particular race or something, very tedious. But you can sit there and count 1, 2, 3, you know, like pieces of paper, yeah, like how many people voted for this person, you know, kind of thing.
Exactly.
And the other thing is, not so let's say somebody hacks the machine at my polling location and messes, you know, so that it just spits out a different number than what we actually put in. If we think that's true, we can take that same stack of ballots and a different tabulator that gets programmed to read that district and run them through again and recount them pretty easily, or sit and count them by hand if we need to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, the number on the machine, how many people voted, how many ballots did we hand out, how many were spoiled, meaning somebody like made a mistake and they said, I want a new ballot, and they started over, you know, and how
There's
many
people. There's only so many, and it's based in fact.
Well, right, and how many names got checked off that, you know, that came to vote. All those numbers have to match. So it's not like we just randomly hand out ballots and people go vote. I mean, there's a lot. And at the end of the night, when everybody's gone, you know, and the public is allowed to come in and watch. But, you know, we declare the polls closed at 8. We do shut the doors, but people are allowed in if they want to come in and, you know, but that's just so people know it's closed. And then we go through all that. We print out the receipt off the machine to see what, you know, the tally are for the different offices, the display on the front.
I'm one of those that watches the tally live.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but, you know, but my point is, you know, like, we look at the number on the machine, we don't look at the breakdown of offices because I'm one district. So it doesn't, you know, it's interesting, but it doesn't tell me anything about who won. But we look at the number on the machine and the number of ballots, the number of names, the number of ballots returned. You know, we do all that. And if they're not right, then we send people back, you know, to recount. Like, in other words, you know, you two were the people checking off names in the book, count them again. Like, you handed out the ballots, count them again, kind of. Because if they don't match, then we know something is wrong. All right, I've been rambling there a bit. We're going to take
you're onto something there. It's security, right?
I
think there's many ways that we can ensure our elections are safe. I think there will always be some, you know, is it just human nature that seek to either manipulate or influence something, or those that will always believe that that has happened? But I'm a true believer in sort of that good government civic duty, in that we have these checks and balances in place for a reason. And, I think it's actually a worthy point that our election polling systems might be outdated, might be unsafe. But things like voter ID laws and, you know, sort of other reforms that are coming down the pike, like automatic voter registration, can help match our DMV records with voters to sort of cut down on some of that ambiguity. So the very process you're describing to me sounds something like has been set, you know, in a way to ensure security, to ensure the confidence of the voters, that they can trust what's happening, whether or not they actually were rooting for that outcome, that they can be like, well, you know, the process did its best. It worked how it was supposed to.
Well, the other thing is that people forget that for example, in the town I'm in a small town compared to the whole state, and even our town has seven districts, which means we have seven different machines, one at each district. So if you want to hack the election to, like, try to change the votes, you know, my small town alone, you have to hack into seven different machines and change them, and then you'd have to do that across the whole state. And then if it was a national election, across the country. So, you know, you'd have to have a massive team of hackers because they have to get to each individual machine and alter it. It's not running off a main...
It wouldn't be people like you double-checking.
Well, right. And honestly, if, as we said, if something came out where it seemed very skewed, they would probably run them again or count them by hand or whatever it is they need to do. We have to take a quick break. We'll come back and... finish up with Ellen Morehouse and talking about ranked choice voting, not Ann's election polling location. You're listening to WICC 600. We'll be right back.
Don't be out of the loop. Stay connected with the stories that matter. The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600.
And Lisa has the day off today. This is Ann Carrick, and we are talking to Ellen Morehouse from Represent.us. And we were talking about ranked choice voting. And before we let you go, Ellen, I didn't want to just go to the break and say nothing. You know, so what's your message for people out there if they want to know more about ranked choice voting, or maybe they think it would be a good thing for wherever they live, and they'd like to kind of get the ball rolling to see if other people in their area agree with them?
So we can definitely learn a lesson from the states and cities that are implementing now. If you're interested in enacting ranked choice voting where you live, give us a call, represent.us. We can learn from the cases in Massachusetts and New York City that are beginning to push this reform to see more choice and more voice at the ballot box, to allow more independent and third-party candidates to run. It actually, research shows, increases civility in campaigning, right? Instead of sort of attacking the other party, they can vie for your second and third choice candidates. They're actually more inclined to collaborate in that way. So I think ranked choice voting can really change the way we vote, and that more and more cities and states should begin to enact right where they live and work.
Yeah, and for people who are still kind of scratching their head trying to figure it out, if you use sports as an example, I'll try not to get too long-winded here because we need to go to the next person. But you know, if you're in a sport that has a race, sometimes first place gets a certain number of points, second place gets less, third gets less, fourth gets less still, and so you could have somebody, they might win first in one race, but the whole competition could be won by somebody who got second in every single race because they actually overall won more races or did better.
And it's actually about a majority, making sure that the majority of American people prefer in some manner this candidate, as opposed to someone winning by 10, 12, 15, 20% of votes in that way and not actually representing us.
Exactly. All right, Ellen Morehouse, thank you again for being with us. Represent.us if you want to find out more. We'll take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk to Personality Hacker about something called Myers-Briggs Personality Types. And if you don't know what those are, then you're definitely going to want to listen. It's very interesting, and that's all I'm going to say for right now. We'll be right back.
On air, WICC 600. Online at WICC600.com. Download the WICC 600 app and Alexa skills. The Lisa Wexler Show, WICC 600.
Lisa, enjoying the holiday today. This is Ann Carrick, and we're going to talk now to Personality Hacker, which I love the name all by itself. Joel Marquette and Antonia Dodge are with us, and first let me just say good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
Great to have you here. I'm not sure if this is a first for the station to have you connected by Zoom instead of phone, but I love it. So I'm going to jump right in because, you know, we could spend days talking about personality types and how they interact and all that, and we only have half an hour. So let's start first. If you guys can just give people a quick overview of Myers-Briggs personality types. I've done it at least three times. I came out the same thing each time, which I totally agree with. I won't tell you what it is now. I'll tell you at the end. and I did some of the training as well. I found it extremely useful, not only to maybe understand myself better, but also to understand other people in interacting with them. And I usually did it in some sort of a team building, leadership, management type of setting where it to help us work together and understand how everybody responds and interacts so that we could move forward on things, which, you know, saying that, I think Washington should all be signed up for this. but so first, just give people people a quick overview of what Myers-Briggs personality types are, what the whole thing's about.
Yeah, sure. So Myers-Briggs is a personality typology system that uses patterns of how people think, feel, sense, and intuit to perceive the world, to take in information, and then to evaluate or determine the worth of that information. And so it combines these factors, the thinking, feeling, sensing, and intuiting, in a pattern that ultimately ends up creating 16 different archetypes. And these 16 different personality types diagnose why people, like you mentioned, you used it in an application that was team building. And when you took the test, and I'm assuming you read a profile on it, that there were things that you recognized about yourself, things that gave you ahas about yourself. And then when you talked to somebody else who had done the same experience and they had some ahas about how they operate and work, then you understood them better. And so ultimately, it's a technology that helps us understand more about ourselves. And since we're the centerpiece of literally everything in our lives, the system or model can be used in literally any application. But the application that most people use it in, self-awareness, understand, putting language to things that that seem to be like unconscious for us, patterns, right, or behaviors or ways of operating,
or maybe things that they already noticed but didn't really understand why they did that all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so once you have language for something, now it feels controllable. Now it feels like something you can do something about, as opposed to just a fish in water where you're completely saturated in it. And so then it's more about being able to control your personality and have your personality, as opposed to your personality having you.
Yeah. I know when we did, the first time I did it was in college. It was for training for both being a resident assistant and RA and for student government officers. And a lot of the people, like I said, I did mine. I'm like, oh yeah, that's me. But there were other people, they were like distraught that whatever the results came out as, they did not agree. And the biggest one they seemed to have trouble with was whether they were an extrovert or an introvert. Like people, whatever the test indicated they were, there were a lot of people who seemed to violently disagree with that. And do you find that there's one category or another where people are most surprised?
Well, I think there's a couple different things. First, tests are, they always have an error rate. So a lot of typology, when people get into systems, it's like the taking the test is like the starting point, and then they navigate to their what's called a best fit type over some research and sort of figuring things out. Because, I mean, we come into tests, especially ones that are called forced choice, where you have to like choose A or B, where nobody is either A or B. We're always like a combination of those things. And mm-hmm. So your mood and where you're at when you take the test oftentimes very much informs your results. So it's unsurprising when people go away with a type that doesn't fully resonate with them. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that anything is wrong or anything isn't working. It just means that that was the mood you were in that day. And so most people find a best fit type through research and not through online tests.
Okay.
That said, the thing about extroversion, introversion, especially recently in recent times when they've had what I would call like an introvert movement, where everybody has now gotten this concept of extroversion and introversion in sort of the collective unconscious. And a lot of people are very much identifying as introverts these days. And I think it's because, number one, we live in a very extroverted culture. And so we're all trained to be extroverts and to live, you know, sort of louder than maybe some people would like to. And we identify very strongly with that, or we identify with the fact that we hate that. We hate that the culture requires this of us. And so when we get test results back that tell us that we're extroverted when we feel like we're an introvert or vice versa, sometimes that can be unsettling.
Oh, okay.
But what's nice is that, so a lot of people that are familiar with Myers-Briggs are familiar with like the four-letter code, like ENTP or ISFJ.
Right.
But really, it's built on a foundation of something called cognitive functions, which is rooted in the work of Carl Jung. And those cognitive functions are different ways that the mind is wired to take in information and make decisions on it. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is that there are four introverted functions and four extroverted functions. And all of us have a combination of these things. So in reality, all of us are both introverted and extroverted. That's how everybody is. That's how we are all wired. And that makes sense because all of us have to have a way to engage with our inner world and understand who we are. And all of us need to get outer world feedback. Otherwise, we, you know, either direction would be pathological. So when people go, no, I'm more introverted than extroverted, or I'm more extroverted than introverted, but see both things in them, that's because both things are operating them all the time. And that four-letter code is basically an oversimplification to try to point to those cognitive functions and the sort of the deeper wiring of how people are operating. And I think this is one of the reasons why people get really sort of fussy about the concept of personality types and don't like things like typology systems because they think that it puts them in boxes. But particularly with Myers-Briggs, that four-letter code is actually, it's like a decoder ring to get to that deeper wiring. And I think more and more in like Myers-Briggs communities, those cognitive functions are becoming the thing. So when you took the test and you like, you know, did it for team building, everything that's going to be on a team building or on an application that's business oriented is going to stay with the absolute most shallow layer because you're dealing with a whole group of people and you're trying to get a lot done in a small amount of time. But if you crack the hood of the car and you go in and see the deeper stuff, there is a lot there and none of it puts people in boxes, but it does help diagnose why we behave the way we behave.
Yeah. And I think we spent the first time I did it, I think we spent several days with like whoever the trainer was, who somebody from outside our group who supposedly was an expert on it, you know, but talking about it. And we did different exercises where they grouped us by certain characteristics, like the four letter codes you're talking about, before we knew what we were, like just to see how we, you know, so that we could see how we work together with different groupings. You know, and that's why I said I found it very useful because, again, you know, as a resident assistant, you're dealing with all the other students who you're sort of responsible for. So you have all these people and you need to understand how different people respond and react to things. And I think, you know, my family thought it was so interesting when I explained it to them that we went as like, you know, my parents, my siblings to go have the test so we could see how we work together and why certain people butt heads sometimes on different tasks. You were talking about extrovert and introvert. My memory is that there, you know, as a society, there are many more extroverts than introverts. Is that still considered true or is that old thinking?
So a lot of that comes from basically, if I'm not mistaken, like a single set of research that was primarily focused on kids in high school.
Oh, okay.
And high school is the most extroverted time period in a person's life. So the numbers of introversion, extroversion in society or culture were skewed. And if I'm not mistaken, the best information and the most recent information indicates that it's pretty much a 50-50. 50% are introverted or like prefer an introverted attitude or activities and things that allow them to stay in an introverted space. And
is 50% technology, is this technology adding to that though? Because, you know, if everybody is doing their own thing with their computer and their phone and their tablet, that sort of sounds like an introverted type of lifestyle versus going out and having to actually interact with people in person.
So there's I would agree. Yeah. Technology is allowing us to be, I would actually on that level, not necessarily say introverted or extroverted. I would say more social or antisocial. I think our culture allows us to be as antisocial as we want to be. And I think that that's one of the big misnomers about typology in particular is that, or extroversion and introversion, is that the assumption is extroversion is about being social and introversion is about being antisocial. But really it's about where you get your energy and which world is the real world to you. Is the inner world the world of your inner terrain and who you are, how you think, feel, all of that stuff, is that the real world? And when you have to interface with the outside world now, oh, it's exhausting because it's not mirroring back to you how you feel inside. That's more of an introverted attitude.
And I'm glad you brought that up because a lot of people do think introvert, like you are unable to interact with other people, which is not at all what this means.
No, no. Yeah. And extroversion is more that the outer world is the real world. And so you have to go to the outside world to, you know, it's almost like to reconcile your truths. You have to seek them in the outside world. So extroverted activities can be done alone. You're just entering the outside world. You're doing things like maybe getting something done, maybe pushing a project forward. Maybe you're out hiking and you're in nature, in the wilderness. These are all outer world activities as long as that's where the focus of your attention is. Whereas introverted activities are anytime you're going into your inner terrain. So an introverted person, particularly one with high emotional intelligence, can be quite social and really gracefully social and enjoy social interactions. It's just over time, they need to go get some alone time to go back into that inner terrain.
They need to recharge.
Exactly. And extroverted people can be quite awkward and not know how to engage in the social world because maybe they're focused on something that isn't social when they go to the outside world. So they just haven't clocked any time engaging with people. But that doesn't mean that they don't enjoy quote unquote outer world activities. So I think that concept of introversion, extroversion being entirely about shyness or, you know, bombasticness or your, you know, your sociability. I think that that's kind of old thinking. The newer, most, I would say cutting edge understanding of these things is more about how your mind is wired. Introverts go through more processes when they take in information. They have like sort of more neural connections that have to, their information has to be processed through. So they have a tendency to think a little longer about things. And so there's mind wiring in there, brain technology in there that informs some of this stuff that really doesn't have anything to do with your people skills.
Okay. Because we're never going to cover everything here. I just want to remind people that could you all do a podcast? Are these the kind of topics you focus on most of the time with your podcasts?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We talk a lot about this. We do a weekly podcast and we usually take some kind of a topic related to personality types. And we usually do it through the lens of personal growth. How is this going to help you navigate your life in a better way? How are you learning information, making decisions in your life, and interfacing with other people that's going to grow you as a person? You're going to feel better about yourself. You're going to feel better about the people in your life. You're going to understand the people in your life better. And that's definitely what we focus on every week on the show.
Okay. So I just wanted people to know, like, we're never going to fit it all into half an hour here today, but they can go listen more in depth than where you, I'm sure you're breaking it down into different pieces.
Sure. We also have a book too. That's easy to just read some stuff too. That's great.
I don't have to do anything. Just read the book. Yeah, there you go. You know, the other thing I wanted to make sure we mention is, you know, a lot of times people think it's some sort of psychology test to see, like, if you're crazy or have mental illness or something, as if it's a screening process that an employer might use to eliminate you. And that's not at all what this is about.
No. I mean, if you think about it, Anne, there's not 16 personality types, right? I mean, there's over 7 billion people on the planet. There's over 7 billion individual personality
sure.
types. And yeah, it's not, this isn't designed, and I don't think that an intelligent employer, somebody that wants to use this effectively, isn't going to use it to try to screen. Well, that person's this type. I don't like those people. You know, in our consulting work with different companies, we definitely help them understand, like, this is a great tool for you to round out your teams,
right,
to find the people that maybe there's blind spots, because different people have different skills they bring to the table. Look, you're missing this whole group of people over here. Why don't you hire some people here to fill in the gaps where we tend to, I think, as managers, hire people like us that we like, that we get along with, but then we sometimes have lopsided teams. So it's really a tool to actually stretch out and broaden who we hire. It's not to try to, we encourage our clients not to use it to, obviously it's illegal as well, but to, you know, to,
right,
to vet people and not allow them into a company. That's just not, that's
oh,
not
no.
cool at all.
My point was if like a potential employer asks you to do this test, not to think
gotcha.
That they're looking to see if you're crazy. They're really just
correct.
Trying to see how you,
absolutely,
how you process information or something. And
yeah,
there's others out there. I mean, I kind of picked Myers-Briggs because that's the one I'm most familiar with, but there are some others. I've noticed for me personally, because I've had to do different ones at different times, that now if I do it, I feel like, you know, I'm reading too much into each question. I'm like, oh, well, that's like, that's an EI question. And then this one is an NS question. In other words, because I've done it too many times. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Where I feel like, oh, if I answer that, like, I think that's going to make me look like this. Like, well, you know, then it's like I lose track of what was my real answer. I have no idea anymore. You know?
Well, I think that's the challenge, is that we massively overvalue what the test is going to spit out to us. And so then it becomes all about the test and taking the test and what are going to be the results of that. But really, that's just a launching pad to an entire world of very interesting insights into human behavior and, you know,
discovery.
Self-discovery. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think when people obsess about the test, then, you know, I mean, yeah, it's like it's an instrument, right? Like it's like obsessing about a tool. It's like, okay, but what are you going to do with the tool? Like,
right,
how are you going to take it out into the world? And so, yeah, I think when people just focus on that test, and particularly when they get kind of a bad taste in their mouth, like, oh, it didn't spit out the results I want, then, I think you can use it that way if you choose to, but you're basically taking a beautiful machine out for like a quick little test drive around,
right,
the neighborhood. And it's like, okay, well, you can do it that way, but there's so much more capability in that.
Sure. All right, we need to take a quick break here. We'll come back and talk more to Personality Hacker. We have Joel Mark Witt and Antonia Dodge on the phone, or not even on the phone, I'm sorry, via Zoom with us talking about personality types. We'll be right back to continue the conversation here on WICC 600. And again, Lisa's enjoying the day off. I'm Ann Carrick. We're talking to Personality Hacker, which better known as Antonia Dodge and Joel Mark Witt. So before we go to the news at the top there, if somebody's been listening, I'm sure they're, if they've done it, they know what we're talking about. If they've not ever done something like this, they're probably lost. But if they're interested, what's the best way for them to go ahead and, you know, find out more? Or I know there's online tests that you can do. They're not probably as extensive as the ones I did where it was like in a training environment with somebody who was running the whole program. But, you know, where should somebody go if they think, gee, this sounds kind of interesting, I'd like to know more about this?
Yeah. I mean, of course, I'm going to mention that they can come to our website just because that's where we're living. So, personalityhacker.com, just how it sounds. And we actually do have an online test. Again, there's an error rate in every test, even the official Myers-Briggs test, because there's a bunch of online tests. There's an official administrative test. Any test is going to have an error rate. And what we encourage people to do is start with a test. And then if that doesn't resonate with you, continue to learn and try to find what's your best fit type. Don't just take a test result if it's not resonant with you as your personality. And I think that's a good starting point, is to take, you know, go ahead and take an online test that looks like it from a reputable company. You don't have to just take ours. It could be any one of them. And that's a great starting point, quite frankly.
And if somebody wants to do this, maybe like for an office or for some sort of organization, like where it's going to be a large group of people, where do they go about finding someone who can come in and not just to do the test, but can sort of go into more in-depth explanation of how to use that information now that you have it?
Yeah, I think, we do consulting with companies and corporations and businesses and nonprofits and other, there's a lot of practitioners that do these kind of things. So typically in any city, in any place that you live, you have there, you know, if you do an online search, you know, Myers-Briggs Consulting or Myers-Briggs Corporate, there's going to be people that are certified in your area that can come in and do work with you. And that's something that we've done. We've consulted with all sorts of different companies like Zappos, American Express, Oracle. We've done a lot of different corporate consulting things to help teams function better. And that's something that is really useful in that.
Yeah. And that's what I said. I find it very useful. I told you I wasn't going to say what I was up front, but I have to in order to make my next comment. I'm an INTJ. And I know my best friend from college is the exact opposite, ESFP. And so even when we get together now, sometimes, you know, after like a day full of things and she has something else she wants to do. And she'll probably ask me like three times. I'm like, no, I'm good. Just go, you know, and then all of a sudden she'll be like, oh, you need to take care of your eye tendencies. I'm like, exactly. And she's like, all right, I'll see you later. I'm like, have fun, you know, go to it. And it's just because we've both done it. I can't tell you how many times that's happened, like in the years since I've been in college, where it takes her three questions each time. And then she's like the light bulb goes on, like, oh, no, wait. And just like she's had enough. And now she needs a little time by herself to recharge. And I'm perfectly happy that she go and do something else. It's not that I want her to stay and like, you know, chill and unwind. She doesn't need to unwind. She's ready to go. I'm like, go have a great time. I want to hear all about it later.
That's great, right? Because you have an interfacing ability.
Yeah, exactly. You would be a prime candidate. It kind of makes me, that makes sense why you were asking about introversion, extroversion questions, because as an introvert with the career you have right now, it probably feels almost like those two things don't reconcile. Like you have a career where you have to talk and you have to come up with quick thoughts and you have to be entertaining. And yet you're an introvert that needs to go have your alone time. And so those clearing up some of those misnomers about what those things mean can be really powerful for a person, because then like somebody like you, that's an introvert that needs permission to go take that alone time. Something like this might be the first time you got the permission to do it. Right. Cause I think that's the most powerful component.
Part of it. Yeah. I mean, I know in the initial training, like the first time when nobody knows anything, you know, like we'd never heard of it and I didn't know what I was, you know, that was a training that went on, I think for probably like 15, 16 days straight, kind of in the same room with almost the same people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was multiple things. It wasn't just Myers-Briggs. It was a whole bunch of stuff, but you know, the Myers-Briggs was done like at the weekend in the middle of that long stretch, you know, and one of the things the trainer said was, you know, if I said right now, hey, let's all go over to the apartments, we'll get pizza, we'll have a party around the pool, and I think I turned to the person sitting next to me, like under my breath, said, just shoot me. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, I just want to go back to my room and be left alone. And he said, the extroverts are saying yes, and the introverts are saying, like, I couldn't think of anything I'd like to do less, you know? And I know that people who meet me, especially through this career, you know, do not believe me ever that I'm an introvert, because they see me emceeing event, they see me, you know, anchoring the news, hosting a show, mingling at a party, like representing somebody I work for, you know, and they're like, there's no way you're an introvert. I'm like, you're missing the point. You know, I said,
yeah.
It's not that I don't enjoy that and I like doing it, but, you know, I get to a limit, you know, and I've said the other thing for me is, you know, that if I know, let's say for 2 weeks, I'm going to be doing all sorts of things that are more extrovert in nature, you know, I can sort of pace myself. But if somebody came to me at the end and said, we need you to do 2 more days, I might be like, I can't do it, you know,
yeah,
because I've paced myself. And now I'm like, okay, I'm like, I have my eye time, like in sight, and you're taking it away from me. Now I might have a problem.
Yeah. Like you apportioned it out carefully. And if you add more to that, you did not factor for that. You don't have anything for the swim back, so to speak.
Exactly.
But I think typology is best understood when it's less about an individual's capacity and capability than it is about things like their needs,
yeah,
and giving themselves permission to get those needs met.
Okay. All right. We do have to check the news. I want to say thank you again. PersonalityHacker.com. If you want to find out more, Joel Markwit, Antonia Dodge, thank you so much for being here. It is time for the news at WICC 600. And then we will be talking about healthcare right here.